You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. So before we get to our guest, I just wanted to share a little bit with you about where I'm at right now. Our baby, Cecilia, just turned 6 months. And as a lot of you know, I took a break from actively auditioning to take a more steady day job to get the maternity leave to allow us to make this leap into parenthood. And I'm getting itchy. You know, the maternity leave happened, and then when I had to come back to work, that carrot wasn't at the end of the stick anymore. So I was trying to listen to the advice of one of my lovely guests, Pepper Binkley. Her father always told her to have something to look forward to. So I was trying to figure out what was the next thing I could look forward to with this job. And I figured maybe there was something when I have this really steady paycheck that I can, some financial goal that I could set that would be satisfying. So I decided to pay off my remaining student loans from Juilliard before our 10-year anniversary of graduating this May. So I started making some large payments in February, and I'll have the remainder paid off by May, right before the 10-year anniversary. So I'm really excited about that. I'm proud of that, and I wanted to share it with you. I'm working those baby steps, trying to find positive outcomes where I'm at. And I'm also looking to get back into acting projects, so hit me up. So my guest today is Charlotte Bidewell. Charlotte is an actor, dancer, and creator. We went to Juilliard together, where she was in the dance program. And then she went on to go to grad school for acting out at the Old Globe, and is making her own work at a furious pace. She is a bold, energetic artist, and I've wanted to share her story for a long time. You can check out her website, charlottebidewell.com, for more information on her upcoming projects. And I hope you enjoy the 131st episode of The Compass. What do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
I feel like over... we were just saying 10 years since we finished school. Mm-hmm. I've learned so many strategies for taking myself out of the dark places. And I've just been realizing this week how little I actually use those tools. So there's like a very long list of amazing things that I at various times have utilized,
right,
to pull myself back to creativity or just general sense of joy. And I mean, meditation is a huge thing for me.
That's one you do utilize regularly?
Well, you know, I was in a very productive way when I was in graduate school for acting out in California. And I feel like people find meditation in California. That's kind of something that happens. And I was doing it, and I was in this incredibly productive phase where I just felt like all of this brain gunk cleared. Mm-hmm. And I was writing more, and I woke up in the morning and I was energized and I wanted to do my craft. And like my mantra at the time was, let the passion for what you do rise to the surface. And I felt that in such an intense way. But then the meditation place where I was going ended up being a sort of cult situation.
Oh, no.
And I got involved in this very dark world of like homophobia and not being allowed to have personal relations with the men that were meditating with me. So like they wouldn't come to my shows, but the women would come. And I ended up, you know, wanted me to enlist in this group, and there was going to be celibacy involved. I mean, it just got very weird.
This is not where I expected
it wasn't
this story
what
to
I
go.
Expected.
I thought you were going to say I just got busy and I got distracted.
No, I mean, I wish it was something, you know, just like I moved away from it in my own way, but actually it was a very tumultuous time.
How did you get out of it?
Well, luckily I was in therapy at the same time, which is what grad school insurance allowed me to do, which was lovely.
That's where I started going to therapy at Juilliard when it was free.
Oh yeah, that's actually my mom. Her biggest memory of Juilliard orientation week was one of the actors at this panel for the parents saying like his Juilliard mantra was get thee to therapy, because like the therapists are there in the dorm room, so like go.
Right.
But it took me till grad school till I actually went. But she, this therapist I was seeing at the time, I was explaining the events at the meditation studio to her, and she very clearly was like, you have to stop. You cannot go. This is not right for you.
And so have you found
a way to keep it in your life?
Well, that's the problem. I haven't.
It was because you started going to a physical group, not just doing it on your own.
Yeah, just like me and this group and this sort of philosophy and way of meditating, which was so powerful for me and very effective, which is what made it harder to sort of see that it actually was very flawed.
Right.
And I have tried since moving back to New York. I've looked at different groups and gone here and there, but I sort of have like cult PTSD. Like I can't, if anyone starts to try to enlist me in anything, I'm like, go the other way, like run out the door immediately. So that meditation thing that was so powerful, and I still know intellectually is powerful and like does need to come back to the fore of my daily existence, is just a bit tarnished right now. So I've kind of lost touch with it, I guess. And, you know, things like Alexander technique, which are very related to meditation, have also proven to be so useful to me, especially coming from a dance background. That time to reconnect to my body and to use my brain to influence how I feel physically. It's just like a hugely powerful tool that I, again, don't do as much as I should, even though I'm saying right now that it's good for me. And the times when I am religious about it and, you know, disciplined in that way, I feel the difference within a few days. So it's just about, I guess, a sort of personal rigor to keep those positive practices alive.
Well, speaking of Alexander technique, like they always talk about renew, like renew the thinking. Yes. And that's kind of what I feel like we always have to do with reminding ourselves about these things that we know are ways out.
We know them.
These tools,
I always go back to something that my voice teacher in grad school said about learning, because, you know, with the voice, it's so kind of fluid and things happen in your environment and then you lose something that you learned the week before. Or you get nervous and then all of a sudden everything clamps up and you don't have the vocal ability you had yesterday. So she would say that learning is like a spiral staircase and you always kind of feel like you're in the same place, but actually you're just getting a little bit higher up the staircase all the time. And that was a really powerful thing for me in my education and like taking that in as I was going to classes every day. But then now I'm seeing how it's true in my positive practices too, that I move away from them and then realize their benefit and come back to them. And just hopefully over the course of the next decade, I'll spend a little more time in the positive ones.
What does the dark side look like for you most often? When I say that, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the dark side is right around the corner all the time. I feel it's very present in my every choice. Because decision making is one of the hardest things for me. And that's present at any moment, really. You know, like what are you going to eat right now? What time are you going to go to bed right now? Like those small mundane things are at times very challenging for me. And then the bigger choices of like what project are you going to commit to for the next 6 months? Or, you know, what path are you going on with your career and what's that going to look like for the next 6 years? So I find that the darkness is just this chaos that I could descend into so easily. If I just like open up the doors, it's right there and I can go crazy in it.
How did you get around that? Like, you've made some very, like, strong turns in your career.
Yes.
Going to Juilliard for dance, then going to grad school for acting.
Yeah.
Now you're kind of, like, mixing them all together and making your own work, which is awesome. How did you get over that speed bump of, like, indecision?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I think that one of my tools to combat the indecision and the darkness is reconnecting with a sense of fearlessness that I had very strongly as a child. So I made a lot of really bizarre choreography as a kid, like where I played men and I, you know, was doing dances to a metronome when I was 8, you know, very kind of like out
avant-garde.
There. Yeah, very avant-garde. And actually that's why Juilliard came into my life, because when I was 13, 14, I met a ballet teacher from Juilliard and she came to Montreal where I was growing up and we did a choreography workshop and I made this very bizarre dance and she was like, you know, you should consider going to Juilliard. I mean, I'm 13, you know, like, she's like, we need to cultivate your talents. At the time it was a different director of the dance program, so it probably was maybe more apt to my skill set back then. But anyway, so I just find that I can overcome my indecision and my panics and my neurotic tendencies by doing something terrifying and at the same time unbelievably thrilling. Mm-hmm. So like over the summer, I did stand-up comedy a couple times because I felt like I was in a bit of a rut and I was coming off of having made my first film and it was going into the festival circuit and there was just a lot of waiting,
right,
with a lot of rejection and a lot of just questioning about what's the next project after such a big sort of creative birth.
Right, especially when you're waiting to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, and like I had never done this before. I'd never been on a film track. I'd never produced something that could exist forever, you know, because I'd always made live shows that once they happened, they were kind of done. And then mm-hmm. it was about pushing the product to get the show to happen again versus just like, I can send the Vimeo link to anyone and anyone can see this movie. So there's a different type of business mindset that I have to have now. But I kind of was just feeling a bit lost and confused and dark. And so someone I met in a bar ended up being a stand-up comedian, and I was had had a few too many margaritas. I was like, well, I've always wanted to do stand-up. And he was like, well, I could book you for next week.
Oh, my God.
And then I just felt like, well, this has to be a gift from the universe to, right, like, you know, a slap in the face to get out of this rut.
How did it feel once you had done it?
Horrible. So horrible.
But you did it. Yeah, you survived
it. I did it, and I
that
did it again.
Feeling.
Which is also shocking. I mean, I've never been more terrified. That was really the one thing that I thought, you know, minutes before it was happening, before I was the comic on stage, I have to leave. I have to get out. Like, they can say my name, but I will not get on the stage. But I have this, you know, when I'm in scary situations like that, I'm also so conditioned to do what I'm told that if I've told myself to get there and I'm in the room and I have the routine, there's no turning back. You know what I mean? Like, I trick myself into it.
I love how you just said that, how you're conditioned to do what you're told, but you're using that to your advantage by telling yourself what to do.
I've kind of learned that.
Because a lot of, I feel like I, like, there's a part of me that definitely has that, like, good girl mentality that I was, like, raised to be good and nice and do what I was told, you
Yes,
know?
Totally.
And it's something that I have to break out of as when I'm in a... Yeah, like a decision-making process or as an adult person.
Yes, totally. And I feel like especially with a, you know, a rigorous dance training through adulthood and like early adulthood and our adolescence and adulthood, I have this sense of like I need to take care of myself always. Like my body needs to be well. I need to be rested. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always like sort of conscious of my well-being. And when I let that take over, I miss out on the fearlessness of just like, get out there. You're fine. You can do this. You're so much stronger than you think you are. So I have to trick myself into those situations. Yeah. And something I've been telling a lot of my friends who are asking me for advice on getting creative projects off the ground, I just say like, apply for things.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask you, like with all of this self-producing you're doing. Mm-hmm. And these solo shows or things you're collaborating on, are there resources that you found that were really helpful as far as finding grants, finding festivals? Right. Like how do you, or is it just a Google search?
There's definitely some Google searching.
Mm-hmm. Where did you start like discovering all that stuff?
I think, I mean, the first thing, if I remember correctly, that I did out of school on my own was my big solo one-woman show, mm-hmm. Woman of Leisure and Panic, which has now become like the brand of my life. And as much as
it's
I tried to distance
title.
Myself,
I
know
it.
The title started the whole thing. Like there was no piece, there was just a title. And then I lived 3 years as an adult outside of school and all of a sudden there was a piece. but that, I don't even remember now how I found it, but I applied for a solo show festival. And I guess I saw it online or someone forwarded me an email and the deadline was like in 3 days. So I had those 3 days, it was over a weekend, to write the piece mm-hmm. and formulate language about what the piece was about and what my intentions were. And so I
went
from zero to done.
From the application process, how long was it till the actual show?
Like 6 months or something.
Okay.
And I spoke about the piece as if it was made, even though there was no piece. So there was a lot
Sometimes
of catching up to
that,
do.
That deadline.
Yeah. That's what I find is that if you don't have a deadline and you're... I maybe lack a little bit of, you know, imposing my own deadlines. I need an organization to come in that obviously I've sought out the organization, so it is still independent to a certain level. But I need somebody to come and be like, this is what we need by this day. And then I'm like, great, I can do that. There's no question I can do it. But I need the date. I need the time that this is due. So maybe that's the good girl thing again.
Yeah.
I do well with rules. But yeah, so that was the first thing that I did, and that, you know, was a handful of performances at, in the basement of PS122. Mm-hmm. And that opened up a whole world of downtown theater and solo show making. And then from there, it's like you get on one newsletter, which leads you to some other grant, which mm-hmm. you're on another newsletter that leads to something else. And it just kind of all flows together in that way.
Yeah.
But I do encourage people to like seek out something to apply for, because it forces you to think about the project you dream of. Like really get serious about it and put something concrete on the page.
Now, what is the film you just made? Is that a solo performance as well, or do you have other performers?
Yes, it's just me, and I play three men of different ages.
If you want to send me the Vimeo link, I would love to see it.
I should have sent it to you before we talked.
I know, yeah. I should have asked.
It's actually, strangely, I think of it as a continuation of Woman of Leisure and Panic.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've realized now looking back is that Woman of Leisure and Panic is kind of my 20s, and it really mm-hmm. encapsulates the struggle to organize your own time and how do you become your own person away from, you know, people telling you this is your schedule, these are your goals. And I've moved in now to this next series of pieces called What Am I Doing? Which is like after you've been in your 20s and then you're ending and you're coming towards your 30s, you're like, okay, well, I did all these things. Have I gotten any closer to where I wanted to be? And yet my time is really full and I'm really busy, but like with what?
Yeah.
So the film is this little thing called The Nude Model, which I imagine will be part of this larger work. And it's an experience I had working as a nude model in New York, which was one of my side jobs for a handful of years there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to this art teacher's private drawing session on a Saturday morning in the Lower East Side. And there was only male artists there, which was, you know, not what I expected or wanted.
Interesting.
And I was told that all the females were out of town that weekend. How convenient.
Okay.
So I posed for all these men, and it became apparent that this was like their bro time. Like they just were talking about anything under the sun, their girlfriends, hot celebrities, you know, women's periods, having birth, what it does to the female body. And I'm there on this plush rug, just like trying to keep it together. And then they start talking to me about these things and about my body.
And no one's drawing.
I mean, somehow they did make work, which was what was so fascinating about it, because they were both being these awful people, but creating really remarkable work.
Did it actually feel like it was a class, or was it like a group of friends who decided this was going to be their like dinner party?
Yeah, it was more the latter. Yeah, okay. It was like a bunch of teachers from this one school that get together for their time on Saturdays.
Oh, and teachers. That's even weirder that they would do that to somebody.
I know. Like they should know of anybody what the sort of bounds of propriety are in that situation.
Right.
So it was a fascinating moment, and I did go back a second time because I realized midway through the session that there was going to be a piece here.
Interesting.
And it's funny, I mentioned that meditation thing at the beginning. That's also going to be a piece that's part of this What Am I Doing series. So I do rely a little bit on my life going into weird places in order to then feed the work, which doesn't really promote leaving the dark side, because the dark side is so, you know, fruitful. Strangely, and unfortunately, perhaps, too. I don't know.
How has the producing side of it been? Do you find that to be draining, or have you come to enjoy it?
I have come to enjoy it. I've come... one of the things I've really learned is how much joy I find in supporting other people's talents. So, again, like one of the things I'll do if I am feeling down is see a friend perform. And the joy that that brings me, and the inspiration that I find from, you know, somebody that I know just takes the subway every day is actually this like incredible singer.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm producing and I'm able to give a platform to, you know, this incredible set decorator that I worked on a short film the last year, to be able to pull them into something that I'm doing, and for us to work together, and for my work to be enhanced by their vision, is just incredible. I mean, it really is equally as satisfying as doing the performance itself or writing the script. So I guess what I am most excited about now is just having a lot more of that, being able to have more opportunities for myself to then give those opportunities to the people that I want to spend more time talking to.
We talked a little bit about day jobs before we started recording. how have you been able to find a balance with like the financial side of putting your work together, day job, spending time having to promote your work, things like that.
Yeah, it's been a real challenge. I mean, I feel like I haven't solved it yet. Like, I'm maybe at the beginning of having some clarity mm-hmm. after 10 years of that struggle. And I think, I guess what I've learned is that I have to be more forgiving of myself and of my career, and that it's okay if there are times when the day job has to take over a few more hours, and not to let that be a sign that the career is failing, which is really hard. Yeah,
that's where I am
it's
right
just
now.
A balance, and yeah. To rejoice in the times when I don't have to do those side projects because I'm involved in a creative process that's really engaging and fulfilling and time consuming and financially profitable. But also sometimes if it's my own work, especially, I have to double down and do a lot more of the side jobs in order to support my own project coming to fruition.
Right.
And that feels harder and harder the older I get. And the more I see that there is money out there and people are finding it, so then right. it becomes, why can't I find it?
Right.
Or why can't I find it more consistently, maybe, is the thing I have to remember. Because it's easy to feel like nothing is working, nothing is happening. But I have to be like, wait, well, that thing just happened. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was 2 weeks ago, maybe it was 2 months ago. But, like, there is some trajectory moving forward.
Right.
So, like, having a little more faith, I guess.
And you were saying that you were teaching some exercise classes right now
yes.
as your day job.
Yes.
Do you find that interest since it's tied to the physical body as you as a dancer, or is it weird?
That is the goal of doing that as a side job. That I mean, it's a bar class, so
right.
It
or
uses...
is it weird because it's just not the thing you actually want it to be? Like, it's not a dance class.
Most days it's that. Most yeah. days it's, and it's also, I find it a bit limiting at times because it's not a class where I'm working with a group of students consistently over a
right.
period of time.
Right.
You know, some clients, yes, are coming all the time. Other clients are kind of shifting in and out. Some people are new. So you're balancing all these different levels.
Right.
And the type of correction that you get to give remains at a certain plateau.
Mm-hmm.
So for someone like me, who I feel like I have a ton of information to give about the body, I only get to give a little piece of it. So when it is frustrating, it's really for that reason.
Right.
But then, of course, you have the rewarding moments where, like, someone realizes what it means to untuck their pelvis and their life is changed. And you're like, great, I just gave you that, you know, at 7 a.m. on a Wednesday. So those are great moments, too. I don't know. I'm also dealing with an injury now, and I have this foot injury. So I can't be as physical as I want to be, and I sometimes even get jealous of the clients who can be, you know, I'm giving them these classes that I want to be taking myself.
Right.
So it's, there's many layers to that onion.
I'm sorry to hear you're injured.
That's all right. It's just a thing. We move through.
Can I ask, since you grew up in Canada, how does that affect the way you're able to work in the US, like with your visa stuff?
Well, that, you know, is
I know it's so complicated.
That was a real struggle for many years. I mean, anyone who's gone through that knows it's just the sheer expense of getting those artist visas is, you know, I was just so blessed that my family in different ways was able to cobble together the funds to make that possible. And I had different choreographers or artists that I was working with at different times in my life that stepped up to support and sign off on the application.
Right.
But it's part of the reason I went back to school. Yeah, so I was working as a dancer and on this artist visa, and that was all actually fairly straightforward because it's not a unionized craft.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started moving into acting and I was getting jobs that would require me to be equity, it became very challenging because equity doesn't have the same rules that the government has.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're approved by the U.S. government to be a working actor or working artist, let's say, in America, equity will not accept that unless it's a green card.
Wow.
Which, yeah, is a huge...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's a lot of foreign actors that I've now met and spoken to about this issue in New York. It's a huge roadblock because you do the challenging thing. You make it to New York, you have the visa, you spent the money on that, you've proven your excellence, the government agrees,
mm-hmm.
and then the union is like, well, not yet. So when I got into this production at Williamstown, and I applied for my green card in order to be equity, in order to do the show. And it lasted, you know, I had like a temporary work card for the duration of the show. But then the green card was denied within a month of the project ending.
Oh, no.
So then I had joined equity, but was now on leave from equity.
Can I get my dues back?
Yeah, I was like, so what do I do now? Like, I can't audition anymore. Like, my green card was denied. Like, clearly I don't have the whatever necessary film credits or my face on a movie poster yet so that they can think I'm worthy of this merit. So then I went back to school because I was like, all right, I'm going to be on a student visa again. I'm going to gather this skill set that seems necessary, you know, for my own artistic progression, but also to get the level of credit that the green card requires. Mm-hmm. So it is always at the back of your mind. Like, I have to spend my time doing a thing that's going to build the resume in the right way, make a shiny program, maybe generate a review, you know, all these things mm-hmm. that the green card application holds so dearly, which maybe if I didn't have that, I wouldn't even consider as a factor in my choices. But then I was very lucky after grad school, I did get my green card. Maybe I just had a better lawyer. I don't know. Our times had changed. But so now I am on the green card, and it's been such an incredible relief. I just get to do what I want to do in that way now.
Now you just have to worry about getting the job. Exactly. Which is enough.
Yeah. Now I'm just worrying about employment. I can stay in the country for 10 years. It's fabulous. Yeah. But I don't really think I have any intentions of becoming American. You know, I think the green card was enough to settle me for the time being.
Well, I was going to ask about what the industry is like in Canada, if you've thought about if that's really an option.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely...
I mean, I grew up going to Stratford.
Oh, yes. Stratford is incredible.
Dream about
I know. It's funny now because I haven't ever been in Canada as a working professional.
Right.
You know, so I feel like I don't know. And
I mean, I know Montreal is a hugely artistic city.
Yes. And for female choreographers, it's like the place. I mean, for whatever reason.
We went 3 summers ago to the big music festival.
Oh, yes, the jazz festival.
Not the jazz festival, the Oceaga.
Oh, nice.
And
we
saw Radiohead there. Oh. And we just fell in love with the city.
Yeah, it was an incredible place to grow up. I mean, I was so blessed to be at the dance studio where I was, which is where Springboard happens. Mm-hmm. So a lot of New York dancers are familiar with it. So it was a very rich, you know, place for contemporary dance. And Quebec is a bit of a matriarchal society, strangely. The women of the house tend to lead the way. I know.
Sounds lovely.
Very lovely. And a lot of, you know, people are together and have children but aren't married, and there's mm-hmm. very strong women who head the household. So it has created this world for female choreographers to emerge in a way that I don't think they have anywhere else in the world to that same level. So when you think about big Quebec choreographers, most of them are women.
That's awesome.
And they have huge infrastructures for their companies. You know, it's not just like they're sort of working independently. They have buildings. They have full-time companies that tour internationally. So, it would be an incredible place to return to, but somehow when that presented itself as the only option with immigration, like, okay, you don't have the money for this visa right now, or the visa was denied, go back to Canada. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even fathom the idea. It felt like a regression in a strange way.
Right. I'm sure in some part, like after living in New York City too.
Yeah.
It does feel like such a hub.
Yes, it does. And I would feel like I was in Canada wanting to come back to New York.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just because we went to Juilliard, and I feel so connected to that community. And a lot of the work that I get now is still because of mm-hmm. that community in the strangest ways. So I'm very thankful for that. And I don't feel like I want to be too far away from it.
Yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
What does your family think of you choosing the arts for your career?
Well, my parents are in the film industry.
Okay.
Yeah, my mom is a product placement person. She was one of the first people that ever would get hired by a film or TV show to do the product placement specifically for them, as opposed to being hired by a brand and mm-hmm. then seeking out opportunities to place the brand.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Yeah. So sort of flipping it. She was working out of Montreal, one of the first people in the world to treat product placement in that way. So she does, you know, a lot of the big projects that come around. And then my dad is a retired TV commercial director and set designer and stuff like that. Cool. So I think it was a shock for them, honestly, when I moved from dance into acting, even though the two are very close together. Right. You know, it's not like I was going off to become an engineer. It was the thing adjacent, and I used a lot of acting in my dancing and continued to use a lot of dancing in my acting. But I think my parents were fearful that I was taking something that I had spent my entire childhood, adolescence, and early adulthood practicing and getting better at and going to Juilliard for, and was throwing it away is a strong word, but sort of like putting it to the side.
Right. Well, especially when it's something where like just physical ability, you have to like keep up.
Yes, and you only have that level of ability for so long. But because they're in the film world, they also were aware of how challenging it was to be an actor. And they were like, can Charlotte act? I think that was like a question for a couple of years at least. Like, will she successfully do this? We have no reason to believe that she can. You know, I'd never spoken on stage before. I didn't even know the sound of my own voice. So it was a huge moment for me when my dad came to see me in my first play and was like, oh, yeah, okay, you're okay at this. Aww. I was like, okay, cool.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, aww. I felt like, all right, so we feel a little bit better about this choice and this little redirect.
Are you an only child?
No, I have an older sister.
Okay.
Yeah, who's a rugby player, actually.
Oh, cool.
She's played for the U.S. team for many years, World Cup stuff. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, we're very... we're like very high achieving physical discipline family, even though my parents are so unphysical.
I love that.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's very strange.
Do you have any artistic mentors that have been important to you along the way?
I definitely had many in my youth. This dance teacher from Juilliard, Alexandra Wells, who I met when I was 13, 14, she helped shape my trajectory to Juilliard.
I feel like I've had several of Juilliard dancers mention
that. Yeah, she is a very strong force. And she approaches dance pedagogy in a way that most people don't. She's very forward-thinking. She's very attentive to the individual and what are your specific gifts as a dancer and how do we bring those to the fore and who do they fit best with. I mean, it was remarkable to have that woman in my life so early. And she... I mean, I don't think I would have gotten to Juilliard without her. She really told me which summer programs to go to, which choreographers to have my solos done by. Like, it was very guided in the best way. And then she worked in close collaboration with the director of Ballet Divertimento, Susan Alexander, who helped form Springboard. She was sort of like the other piece to that puzzle. Mm-hmm. So the two of them were my people.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really, really lucky. Yeah, very lucky. And it's funny, in the acting world, I feel like one of my sadnesses is that I haven't had a consistent mentor in that same way.
Yet.
But on the flip side of that, it also makes me very proud that it's something that I did completely on my own.
Right.
You know, I woke up one morning and looked at Playbill and went to audition for the Flea Theater's company. On the very last day, I got there at the last minute because I had woken up so late and didn't even know what was happening. And I joined the company and did my first play with them. But that was something like I could very easily have just gone back to sleep.
Right.
Or not opened that email. Like, it was such a fleeting moment, but it was completely in my control to manifest. So I feel proud of that. But then as I've gone forward and have had to make decisions about what projects to do and what schools to go to and such, I felt a lack of a kind of guidance from someone further along in their path.
Right.
Yeah, with a little more information about how it could all go down.
Are there any lessons you've learned in the last couple of years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about? It can be something small.
Yeah. I feel like I got like hit in the head in December with the idea of patience. It just, and I've heard it even on your podcast spoken about by other people, and my parents from the industry have told me many times throughout my upbringing that like it takes somebody mentioning your name three times before they call you. And it could be years between those mentions. And you don't even know that your name is being spoken of. And right. then all of a sudden, out of the blue, you get this call and something amazing happens.
And you're like, it's been 10 years.
Basically, yes. I just did this project. I was choreographing for a new television show. Mm-hmm. And I worked with the creator 8 years ago on something that you could never have imagined would lead to this. And we
oh my God.
Haven't spoken in 8 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and he was at a party with mutual friends and mentioned needing a choreographer and remembered, they mentioned me, he remembered me from this other thing, didn't even know that I choreographed. I mean, it was just so bizarre.
That's fantastic.
And then it manifested, and he took a little bit of a leap of faith to give me this position because he had history with me. And I still, now the project is over, and I still can't get over that is how it all went yeah, down.
That's beautiful.
It was really beautiful. And it happened within a few hours of a similar thing happening with a playwright that I worked with 6 years ago. We have a new project coming up in the fall. And he called out of the blue. And I had convinced myself after that project 6 years ago that I had let him down in some way. Because it was
Isn't
very
funny.
Totally the opposite of what I had led myself to believe.
I know.
It was shocking, actually. That was at the very beginning of my acting career, and at that time I felt like I could audition well, but I couldn't actually do the projects because I didn't have the tools
yeah.
to like make it through to production. I could like prepare, I could coach well to like give you a great monologue or give you this scene, but then who knew what happened after that? And I felt like I had disappointed him by the end. Hmm. Gone from like he was super excited at me or about me after the audition to like, well, that was a bit of a letdown. We don't know what happened to her there. And then it took 6 years and we're working together again, and he's very yeah. excited about it, and I'm very excited about it.
I feel like I have to teach myself that over and over, the fact, or I coach myself to be like, you know what, the other person was probably worrying about themselves
yes.
the whole time and probably didn't notice anything about my anxiety.
Totally.
Or, you know, thought I was perfectly fine or whatever.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I've been tracking this playwright through these last 6 years, and he's been doing projects where I thought to myself, like, oh my God, I could be that part. Mm-hmm. You know, he's doing this play. Why isn't he calling me for this? But you don't know what you actually represent to someone. And there's maybe something about that character that he doesn't think is quite right for me, and I can't be the judge of that. And now the right thing has come along and he has called. So just building some faith in in other people, in my own practices and abilities and performances. But this idea of coaching yourself, I think, ties back to what I was talking about at the beginning. I slip away from the positive practices because my self-coaching is not maybe as strong as it should be.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Just like building that strength of mind to pull away mm-hmm. from the negative chatter and the doubting and the worrying towards more positive mantras, really.
Yeah. How has it been for you working in all these different mediums since you graduated from grad school? Like with TV stuff and film
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, it's very strange. It's what I wanted for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what I still want for myself, but it is so hard because I don't always feel like I'm building momentum in my career because the momentum is spread out
right.
across so many different pursuits.
And does the Old Globe doesn't do any film training, does it?
We did a little bit, but it was more like practicing TV sides versus like right. looking at yourself on the screen and
right.
checking out what your face is doing. And it was only sort of like briefly at the end. So
yeah.
it was very theater focused. And I think that's going to change now with Jessie Perez, who's going.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, that's going to be a really, really wonderful thing for them. I'm so thrilled
yeah.
about it. But yeah, I've done a lot of thinking about this question, like how beneficial is it for me to be spread in all these ways? How satisfying is it really in the long run? Like, would I be more satisfied if there was a single focus and I could track that progress
mm-hmm.
and feel it more tangibly? Or is having the opportunity to spread my wings and test myself out in all of these arenas what gets me off. You know, clearly on some level it does because I keep doing it. But also in taking other people's feelings about the type of career that I have, like I've had some sort of Titan-esque people in the industry that I've met and had a chance to speak to about my career be like, oh, you can't do what you're doing. You're only going to be successful if you're an expert in this one thing and you do it every day. Like if you're going to be a filmmaker, that you watch every film. So all night you're watching movies. You're like watching all the greats and you know them by heart and you can say who the DP is and who won the Oscar in 1987, you know?
Right.
And that this kind of, you know, multifaceted career is just like watering too many lawns. Your life is going to disappear and you won't have made anything of yourself. So having that said to you is a very scary thing.
Yeah.
And I don't sort of like brush it off. I reflect on that a lot. And it's balanced with other people being like, well, in this day and age, if you're not doing many things, you're failing.
You know? Exactly. I feel like now more than ever,
yes,
people are many different faceted.
Many. And like, I think actors are being encouraged to be producers and directors
and writers.
Yeah. To do the web series thing or whatever it is, to put on the show, however inexpensively. So I've absorbed so many different opinions from the outside about it and I am stewing on them and experimenting within my career about what is feeling right. But I just feel like I have so many dreams and I work a little bit on them always.
Yeah. Well, and the thing that's so great about what you're doing is because you're making your own work for the times when you're not getting the jobs that other people are bringing to you,
right,
or spearheading, then you're still being productive and you're still moving forward.
Yeah.
Because that's the frustrating thing is that even if you say, okay, I'm only going to do on-camera acting or...
Yeah,
I only want to focus on classical theater. It doesn't mean people are going to give you that job.
No, totally. Yeah, just because you decided it's happening.
Most frustrating thing.
100%. And even, I mean, within your own work, there's the same kind of frustration. Like you might be like, I want to be, like right now, one of my focuses is creating this series of works that will hopefully be some kind of internet series of sorts. And I want that. That doesn't mean it's going to happen. It's going to be very challenging to find the support and the means to make it possible.
Right.
So if you have so many lofty things and you want them all to happen, you're waiting for a lot of gifts from the universe.
Yeah.
But again, with the patience thing, and faith is a big word for me, but not in a religious sense, like in having faith that all the things that the work that I put in, the dreams that I have, they are in motion already. The universe wants the best for all of us, even though it's very hard to remember that. And having faith that the present moment you're in is a step on the road to where you want to be. I just do a lot of self-talk about that.
I should do more of that.
Yeah. It's funny because I switched my thinking about that just 3 days ago. I used to think to myself, to have faith in the future, which put a lot of pressure on this idea that like there's somewhere I'm going that's not where I am now that's better, that's like more successful, happier,
right,
more fulfilled, and I'm just struggling now to like get
I'll
to
be
that
happy
place.
When I get that.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be happy when all these things are happening and I'm living in a different apartment and my student loans are paid off and whatever, whatever. And now I'm trying to take the pressure off the future and bring it back into the now. And be like, I have faith in this present moment that everything that I am aspiring towards is in motion. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, it was a big switch.
I've been trying to start doing gratitude lists, which are a
oh
big
gosh,
thing for a lot
yeah,
of different
gratitude.
People. I feel like Oprah might have started
yeah.
that. But yeah, they're very popular now. But I do find that's one of those things that I should do every day, and I
yes.
do it like once every couple weeks.
Gratitude.
But I'll just do it in my yeah. head too, and it really does help me in the moment to be like, okay,
yeah,
I'm really grateful I have a roof over my head.
Yes.
I'm really grateful I have a family. I'm
yeah.
really grateful, you know, just to take the importance off of
yeah
things that really, you know, that you want, but they're not life or death.
Yes. And also I find in this multifaceted career that I'm managing. It's difficult to acknowledge when something you wanted has just happened to you. So I might be in the middle of a project that like 8 years ago, 10 years ago, even 20 years ago was something I really wanted to do and I really wanted for myself, and I'm doing it right now and I'm just as miserable as before I started it. You know what I mean? And I'm really like, whoa, that is not cool, Charlotte. Like,
that puts it in perspective, that thing we were talking about before about thinking that you'll be happy once you get that thing.
Exactly, because you're getting the thing right now and here you are having some kind of panic about something. And I'm really, that is one of my biggest goals for myself, is to snap out of that and be grateful, be aware, be present in the unfolding of these dreams. And I've also noticed that the dreams happen in ways that are unexpected and not like what you actually dreamed, but yet the result is what you dreamed. So, for example, my short film, The Nude Model, it premiered at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland. And I had always wanted to take my solo work to the Fringe Festival. But I would, every year, I would open up the application and get so daunted by bringing my piece to Scotland. And they don't really produce you. You kind of have to select your own venue and you don't know what the venues look like and it's a whole to-do. And I would just begin and then immediately stop. And then out of, you know, this bizarre series of events, I made this movie and it world premiered there because just 3 years ago they started a film component of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And so I got to go without any of the hassle of self-producing and I got to see my work shown there.
That's awesome.
And I still look at that and I'm like, wow, that is an example. Like, it's an example of how it can happen in ways you never expected. And you have to be cognizant of that and take a moment to rejoice and be grateful for it.
This is good. This is good for, I'm so glad you're telling me this today.
Yeah.
So there's, unless there's something that I have not asked you about that you really wanted to talk about, I have two little questions left.
No, I feel like if I say any more, it's going to be a little too, like a therapy session. I'm going to start telling you about my troubles with gratitude.
Okay. So yeah, just two short questions at the end. When you do find yourself in that like uninspired, dark place, are there any tangible things that you go back to again and again? Like music or books you reread or things you do?
There's a quote by Anna Deavere Smith that was brought to my attention during our time at Juilliard. And I can't remember actually. I think it maybe was one of the teachers there who gave us a book that we all read of Anna Deavere Smith's. And she said something about how when you are most inspired, when you come back to the moment where, when as a child, your heart first opened. So that there was just this thing at a certain age that you first felt inspiration, or you first felt like you were moved by something. And so for me, traveling back to Canada to the cottage where we spent summers growing up and being in that sort of rugged, natural, cold landscape is where so much happened for me as a child. And you know, where I kissed the first boy and like fell in love and had these crushes, but also like was alone in nature. And so I do seek to go back there as often as I can because it resets me. And then things that are attached to that, so like the music of Neil Young, if I just listen to that, I get brought into that place. So in a way, I'm still so Canadian, but so I look for those, like those couple of songs, like some of the Joni Mitchell songs that like my parents would play on the car ride to the cottage. They opened my heart in the way that they did as a child. And that always, I find, grounds me and sets me on a course towards a new creation, which is lovely. Yeah.
And then finally, is there anything of any art form that you've seen recently that you want to recommend?
Oh my gosh. Well, I was at a friend's cabaret on Friday night at Studio 54, and it was only a one-time event, so no one can go to it again. But I just recommend like going to see live singing. Maybe it's for me, that's really what, of all performances, I feel the most inspired by.
I wish I was a singer.
Yes,
so
that's my biggest
disappointment.
That's
how I feel. When I go to things like that and hear people who can really sing, it just feels like such a free mode of expression.
Yes.
And like I can sing, but I can't like sing. And I, yeah, that is, I wish I had that.
I know. I pray for that every day. And it even began when we were at Juilliard. I felt it was the opera singers mm-hmm. that I was the most astounded by, especially because they were so young and they were at the beginning of their training. So, mm-hmm. you know, as dancers, we were getting into Juilliard. We'd already been training for a decade at a high level. Otherwise you weren't going to get in. And these opera singers were kind of like coming out of nowhere and had these huge voices that just erupted from their mouths. And that fascination has continued, and I think it's part of why I gravitate towards Shakespeare as an actor, because it's the closest to singing. Mm-hmm. It's really about like using the voice and using the words and having that be the instrument. So for someone who can't sing, if I can do a Shakespeare monologue well, according, you know, or like in a way that I feel it connected to it, then I feel like I've sung a little aria. Yeah, and there's a few singers that I will seek out. There's this woman named Storm who performs with Company XIV that I've also worked with.
Oh, okay.
And she is someone who every time she sings, my heart opens again and I cry on the first note. So I'll always, you know, look for her and recommend people to look for her performances.
Great.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I don't know. I don't think so. Okay.
Well, yeah. Thank you so much. This was a delight.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. You'll get access to bonus content, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.